Hello, and welcome back once again to the Inquisitor podcast with me, Marcus Cowkey. Today, my guest is Susanna Schuller. Susanna is an international mediator, a coach, and a facilitator, and she heads up the team over at CEDA, the Center for Excellence in Dispute Resolution. And she specializes in helping teams, companies, individuals to reframe conflict as an opportunity. Given the turmoil, the uncertainty that we're already facing and the what's coming, I figured this would be a good primer because a lot of the work that we're doing at the moment is around helping people to develop an understanding of how much agency and choice they actually have, how they can fulfill their purpose and develop really powerful relationships that will help them through these really difficult, tumultuous times. So I really wanted to bring Susanna in. We've known each other for, 10, 15 years. She was a client of mine. We worked in the same building, and we stayed friends for that time as well. She's just back from Rwanda, and she's got some amazing stories to tell. So without any further ado, Susanna, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Could you just give us a couple of minutes on your history? Because it's unusual, to say the least, and it's also instructive that I want people to understand how much we can learn from other disciplines and from people with very diverse backgrounds.
Thank you. Like I think many people, I think life is not always straightforward, and what you think as a teenager or when you finish school, what you want to be is often very different from what you end up with. But as the Rolling Stones say, you might not get what you want, but if you're lucky, you get what you need. I think that's one of my mottos. I'm more resilient with that. There were times when I thought, why don't I get what I want? I started out in Namibia, so my part of my family is third generation in Namibia. It was Southwest Africa, independence since 91. And my parents decided that my brother and I should go to school in Germany. So I ended up going to school in Germany. After my A-levels, I started studying law because I thought that was something reasonably to do and I could help the world be a better place. So then being a lawyer, possibly not many lawyers start like that. But so that
I think a lot of them do.
That is true. And then you get very cynical or you get perhaps like me, a recovering lawyer. So I did international European law as a specialty, and I studied also, I have a French and then Spanish degree. Sometimes you have mentors in your life, and I cut a long story short, but I worked with a French lawyer in his cabinet, and we had lunch as you do. You have long lunches in France. He said to me, listening, he was a very good listener, and I appreciated much later what that means. And he said, Susanna, I think you should stop with law. And you have your nice French lunch in the Provence under nice trees. What? And he really took me totally by surprise. That, of course, first my doubt was, am I not doing a good job for you? He said, no, you're really good, but you're miserable. And I lose money through you. I said, what do you mean you lose money? How can I be good and you lose money? He said, yeah, the clients are happy. So when they go to you, they come out and feel happy and want to settle, but they don't want to go to court. And I can't get billable hours through you because you're very effective in helping them not to argue. So perhaps you should make that a profession. Fast forwarding, I think that was one.
That was very enlightened.
That was really a moment where I later discovered, okay, I needed that because nobody dared to say that to me. And then when I said I stopped law, I had all these friends and family. We never understood why you did it in the first place. And you think, why haven't you given me any feedback earlier? And I was struggling. And then so the idea was, yeah, we wanted you to discover that yourself or whatever. So I'm miserable already for X amount of years. But okay, that's how life sometimes is. So I changed career completely. And because that's possibly my Germanic background, I think you need to accumulate lots of titles. And because with a law degree, in Europe, you have not enough degrees. So I went back to university and got myself a master in applied linguistic sciences, because I thought, I want to understand language. And linguistic means also the culture. So how people tick and think, and how language actually helps you to express what you, perhaps what you want, but also it says a lot about yourself and about culture. And of course, my specialization was French speaking and Spanish speaking cultures. And so I got another epiphany, saying there is so much more. And my thesis is about context. So I learned a lot about context and had a wonderful professor who helped me also get rid of every word that is not necessary. So when I wrote my thesis, it was again an epiphany. He said to me, okay, why do you need all these waffle words? What is it that you actually want to say? And he helped me to be clear, to create a clear language. I still waffle, as you might realize right now, so you have to stop me perhaps in a second. But it's basically get rid of the noise and say what you want to say. It doesn't mean you have to be rude or super direct. You can still be elegant and eloquent and express it with style and grace. But don't sugarcoat, don't waffle, say things. So it was another important lesson. And then
that's telling the kind truth, like the lawyer did to you. This is part of the problem that I see, that we've created this condition in business and in society that's very adversarial. My hypothesis is this. If we create the conditions where our brain and the other person's brain are just gushing with dopamine, both of us will want to come back and do this again. If we're creating the conditions where either one of us is flushing our brains and our bloodstream with cortisol and adrenaline, we will associate that with a threat at an unconscious level. And the next time I phone you up, if you're associating that feeling with me, you'll be reluctant. You won't want to talk to me. It's called the pratfall effect. It just strikes me that we seem to spend so much of our time creating the conditions for conflict and moving into drama, when in fact, if we didn't do those things, then the conditions that we want to get away from just wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. And then we free up about 95% of our life to do the stuff we actually want to do and the stuff that actually matters, instead of being stuck in pointless meetings, writing reports that mean nothing.
And that is a good point you make there, Marcus, because in my experience, I met lots of people who actually can't differentiate what matters and what not. Hmm. And only through encounters I had in my life, like this, where you change completely your career way of thinking, or things are taken away from you, make you think. But to your point, sometimes you don't even have to go to that suffering. I think some suffering in life is necessary to experience some lessons, but you don't have to suffer every single crisis. If you actually learn, take the lesson and say, okay, what is it that I actually want? And then getting rid again of the noise, because then I don't go after shiny objects, but really stay on track.
Well, you've touched on a really important point, which is that the pain is inevitable, the suffering is not. That's a choice. How we choose to respond is the key. And I think we have an obligation to work with our clients to help them make good decisions well, to teach them how to make a good choice and how to discern between a good and a bad choice, and the difference between making the right decision but for the wrong reasons, and then having to live with the guilt and the consequences. Because sometimes, yes, you do have to make cuts and you have to have difficult conversations, but you can do it kindly or you can do it cruelly. And I think we need to maybe reevaluate where we're actually creating and contributing value. Is making 300 dials a day to speak to three people for 1 minute and have to do that for 3 or 4 days to get 1 or 2 meetings, a productive contribution to the outcome? I feel it's not. I feel that's simply busy work, and it gives the illusion of being effective, but it's not. Effective is different to efficient. In the same way that haste kills speed, I think there are many paradoxes in being a leader, for example. Leadership is not about the title or the status or the pay packet. Leadership is how you choose to show up.
Yes.
Can we talk about how someone who wants to succeed within their values can challenge authority, challenge something that is patently wrong, and do so in a way that keeps them safe and intact? Not the big step. I'm not looking for courage. I'm looking for small steps.
Yeah, there are small steps. And again, it's simple but not trivial. It means that you, first of all, are prepared and open to have that conversation. It means you need to put yourself in a mindset that you're open to receive even something you don't like to hear, or to engage with someone you normally rather want to avoid. And then my biggest lesson was when I really learned more about influencing, is you influence people with their own values, with their own ideas, with their own emotions. So if you, and everyone cannot not communicate, you send constantly messages. So if I pay attention or make a deliberate effort to engage with someone, I did that just last week with someone, a colleague I find personally difficult, but he knows that, so we're okay, to listen, and then you just paraphrase what you hear. You don't actually have to do much. The courage is only just basically to say you listen, and then you paraphrase to someone, I get the sense you are frustrated, or I get the sense being punctual is really important for you. If you just keep it really simple, and you have to use an I message, because that takes the whole blame away. So that's, let's say the tip is the formula, create an I message with a word of perception. I hear, I perceive, I get the sense. That takes completely for the listener blame away, that you accuse them of something. And if you then, super powerful, add what you perceived, and they say, wow, yes, or they might say no, still has a huge impact, because that is irresistible. If someone practices that, I get the sense you're frustrated, and you say, no, I'm not frustrated, I'm angry, you get further information. It's wonderful. You can then actually say, so you say you're angry, tell me more. The famous TED method, tell me more, explain to me, describe. And then you can just have a whole conversation with TED. Then the person say, yeah, I'm angry because that report hasn't been delivered, whatever. So you get a whole lot more information, which actually creates an abundance of information you can use in other conversations with that person. You get an idea who that person is. If the person complains a lot, you can listen for what are their values. If I explain about someone who is, let's say, pushy, or says, oh, I hate that person, always pushy, then if you would frame that as a value, you could say, okay, I get the sense you like someone who gives you time to reflect on something so that you can give a good answer. Brilliant. And then the person says, yes, that's what I like. So you got him. And that person will feel that he owes you or she owes you in giving back.
This speaks to a fundamental human driver that all human beings want to be heard, to feel felt, and to be understood. Bless him, Mark Gulston passed over Christmas, but that was his lesson. And the other lesson that I really learned from him was let go or be dragged. Our attachment draws us into drama because our attachment to the outcome, instead of being willing to put ourselves in a position of vulnerability where we may be proven wrong, where someone else's opinion may be more right than ours, where it may be the case that our opinion is validated, but we can only be certain if we listen. And I fundamentally believe there are four pillars to great communication and being a decent human being. which happen to be superpowers in sales and management and leadership and parenting and relationships. And they are deep listening, real empathy, powerful questions, and contextual awareness. Being able to adapt to the moment and recognizing where the other person is and meeting them there, accepting them without judgment. Now, that's difficult if you're attached.
Judgment is a big thing. That is actually exactly the four pillars you just mentioned is, of course, what we teach as a mediator.
All right. Okay.
You're actually the perfect salesperson. A lot of mediators or facilitators don't see that because they still think sales is bad. I think if you're a really principled salesperson or a mediator, you do the same. Exactly what you just said. So you open to receive without judgment. You are prepared to be at service to the other person, which means you step from me to them. So there's the space, you know, the four levels of listening. So one is Stephen Covey mentioned them as well, and others. It's like one, and we operate most of the time on the first three levels, and active and empathic listening is the fourth and the fifth level. We normally listen for what relates to us, and we want to story talk. That's another level, and we want to give advice. That's what we often are paid for highly. Most of the jobs are to give advice. But how can you give advice if you don't know on what really and what the issue is? So if I listen to someone and just selectively wait for the trigger words and I can jump in and tell my story, or I bring it always back to me. So I have to leave the realm of me and go towards the other person and shut my little internal voice up and say, okay, I know you're there. I can't eliminate you, but I can make a deliberate decision to listen to the other person. And my job is then only to paraphrase and to feel what the person says. And that means if I do that in the sales call, the person will automatically get the idea there is someone genuinely listening. And why wouldn't I buy from someone who gives me that service?
Let me just unpick that, because I was just about to bring it back into the sales arena. Let's look at the discovery process. In that process, that syntax that you described, at what point does the mediator or the facilitator bring their agenda?
At no point.
At no point. Okay. And at what point do they raise things that the facilitator or the mediator believes are critically important and they care about?
So the facilitator would do this in a dialogue. Normally it's not about me, it's about the client.
Okay.
And I paraphrase, and together we will then engage in something where we might discover commonalities, and I summarize. But at every moment, I give the client or the party in a conflict the free will to say no or not to engage.
So they have sovereignty.
Totally.
Excellent. And in terms of the intended outcome, from that moment of communication, what is its purpose?
The purpose is to get to know each other better, that I deliver the service, that I'm a thought partner for the client or the party, so they can make a decision which they might have not taken beforehand. So I provide the context they need, or they might need. I offer a different perspective. I offer a reality check. I offer a challenge, which a thought partner does, with permission. I ask for permission beforehand, so that they get a safe space to test their ideas out and different views, which they might have not taken into consideration by making a decision. And I want them to arrive to a decision they have done in a fully informed context, thought it through. And if they then also decide to buy me, fantastic. If not, they're not. Of course, as a mediator, I'm not interested to shape the outcome. It's in control of the conflict parties.
Okay. So just to clarify, if I understand it correctly, you create the conditions where both parties are making commitments to one another in service of the other parties objected. Everybody has sovereignty. Everybody is coming at this with the shared intent to achieve resolution.
Yes.
And the starting point is opening yourself up to listening and hearing what the other person cares about, what matters to them, and having them map out a pathway to accomplish that outcome only as a facilitator, not influencing either the direction, the velocity, or the outcome.
Absolutely.
And leaving them to take ownership and responsibility for its design, its execution, its measurement, and the outcome, and for them to be the hero in the whole process. Is that a fair summary?
That's a top summary. I will copy that for my next mediation description, because that is, they have full accountability, and that needs to be clear. I'm not interested in conflict parties, so I'm not willing to take on accountability. If not, they can delegate it to a judge.
Okay. So, right, we're going to step things up a little bit. So buckle up, listeners. Okay. The majority of management, leadership, business structure, hierarchy is a surrogate parent-child relationship where we abdicate responsibility to our leaders to make the decision so we don't have to, and then we can blame them when it goes wrong. So let me introduce you to a concept that I got from a genius called Peter Block. If you haven't listened to his audiobook, The Right Use of Power, it is a must. If you are entry level, listen to this audiobook. It will teach you how to empower yourself, because my fundamental belief is all human beings, and certainly the people who are attracted to this message, want choice, they want purpose, and they find that through their relationships. Success is not through extrinsic baubles and the money and so on. They define success as achieving all of that and being top of the leaderboard and all of that fun stuff. But what they are is present and joyous in every moment, whether at home, at work, at play, whatever they are doing. And they are doing things within their values. So when they look in the mirror, they can feel content that they are doing important and meaningful work. And the legacy that they are leaving behind is a reputation. I think in sales, we need to start operating this litmus test, which is, I wouldn't want it done to me. And I sure as hell don't want to be known for being someone who does it to others. I think that's a really good baseline.
Yeah, I think that's a good life motto. I think that a lot of problems wouldn't exist in this world. I sometimes think that, for example, school or university tries to brainwash you the opposite way, so you can actually be easily hijacked and manipulated in just being a consumer and not a human being that is purpose-led, which we actually are born with. We are born with, as you said, a brain, but we are not born with the instruction page, how to use it. We learn it often far too late, how we can make effective use and actually take control of life. And life doesn't have to be a suffering. Misery is optional. And as you said, happiness is a choice. It's really to make something with that and cut out the noise as well.
Well, what I see time and time again is the different factions pointing the finger of blame. And I always like to ask the question of leaders when they say to me, well, our salespeople, we need to fix our salespeople. And my question is this, Susanna, did you hire them that way or did you make them that way? Because they came one way or another. No one pops out their mother's womb able to sell badly or well. However, they do pop out curious. They're learning sponges. They're constantly looking to adapt. And what we seem to have beaten out of ourselves and become willing and complicit, and we become accomplices is that we don't stand up when we know something is wrong, out of fear, out of uncertainty, out of cowardice. Now, I understand if you're 18, 20, 25, 29, whatever, you probably look up to gray old fusty dinosaurs like me and think we know what the hell we're doing. Mostly we don't. We're big kids trapped in adult bodies. And you absolutely have the right to question, because if you are being asked to compromise your word, your reputation, by being asked to lie, to omit, to exaggerate, to try and put someone under pressure to buy before they are ready in order to meet your valuation target, I believe that is a dereliction of duty by leadership. And you need to be able to say, you know, I'm not comfortable doing that. Mm-hmm. If I were to say no, what would happen?
That's a good question. I think that's an essential question for in every life position. What's the cost of not saying no? I think in some countries, you might lose your life. As a salesperson, you might lose your job. But, you know, I think it's face your worst fears to be able to conquer them or to actually work with it. And I think a salesperson, for me, coming back to sales, is really in our business, for example, until I could use the word sales, and you helped me with that, I was almost like I was a witch, or I was like one of these dark arts. And now my team, when I think, should we give a discount, say to me, why? So I think you can actually change people in a value-based way, how to think about sales as you communicate with someone to offer them a service they wouldn't have known about. Yes, and services you pay money for improving your health, wealth, or relationships. If I can help you with that, what's wrong with earning money for helping someone? But we would also help someone, you know, I don't put this attitude on just in professional life. I see that I apply that in my personal life as well. It's the same principles.
This comes back down to being able to be authentically yourself. The challenge that I see is so many people, and when I was in my first sales job straight out of university, my first boss, a guy called Nick Nicholson, was a sales trainer. He trained the cement industry. And on my first day, he said, Marcus, always stay hungry. Spend more than you earn. And I believed him. And for about 18 years, I just got myself into deeper, deeper debt. Because what he didn't equip me with was the actual skills required to be able to fund a lifestyle that was like that. And so, like many people, I ended up numbing. For me, food was a huge outlet. I've lost over 100 pounds in the last 12 months. I've been carrying that weight around since I was a kid because I was buying into all sorts of things that didn't feel right. Mm-hmm. I'm not blaming anyone. I made a choice. You know, I was only following orders. I still pulled the trigger. So I'm trying to find a way to encourage people to put their hand up and say, I want to succeed in life and in business, but I want to do so on terms that make me feel decent inside. I want to feel clean. I don't want to feel like someone else paid the price for my success. I don't want to feel dirty because I had to lie or I had to put someone under undue pressure when they weren't ready, or miss sell or sell to someone who didn't need what I had. And I did it just because I felt I had to.
Also, if you know you can, it's like abusing the power, the influencing without integrity.
Yeah.
And you do it because you can.
You hear a lot of sales trainers that have this macho approach that you've got to power through objections. You've got to lap up and soak up the rejection as if it's a badge of honor. Well, it strikes me that that's just a dumb way of looking at things. Why not look at the better question, which is, how do we not create the conditions where people want to tell us to go boil our head? How do we create the conditions where they seek us out? What do we have to do so that I don't have to do 10,000 dials to get one piece of business over the line? I mean, it does seem incredibly wasteful of life. I'm a big fan of Pascal's reverse wager, which is that if there isn't a God and you still perform and you behave well, if there is one, you get brownie points. Because you did it without having someone on your shoulder telling you you had to. It's the right thing to do.
If you get that moral compass right within you, that you find that and then you find ways to stick to it, I think that is important. And if we don't help our children as well to find what their moral compass is, they get lost and hijacked by all that noise out there, which is all, you're basically a bobbing cork in the sea rather than actually taking your own destiny in your own hands.
And again, I think that we have a really incredible generation in Gen Z. Whatever you think of her politics or her perspective, Greta Thunberg speaking to the UN, every time I think about it, it sends a shiver up my spine with absolute delight. And her righteous indignation and just looking at the venal hypocrisy that was being reflected back and then the backlash that she's endured afterwards, it tells me that the quality of her enemies demonstrates how right she must have been. And I think we need to start taking ownership by betraying someone or something. I think we need to betray the business model. I need to think we need to betray the way we measure things. I think we need to betray shareholder value. And we need to really ask the question, well, what is it we're trying to do? Why does our business really exist? Why am I in sales? What am I doing to contribute to the bad state of affairs? What are the undiscussables? How are we wrong? Who's doing a better job despite all the evidence that tells me that we're in recession? Some people appear to be doing remarkably well. Why? Mm-hmm. Instead of whining, moaning, complaining, and blaming.
Yeah, that is so, actually going to the virtuous triangle, not staying the drama triangle, which is so comfortable. And I give you another metaphor, because we work in our work with people from the police and also with hostage negotiators. And they often get asked, so how did you talk them out of the bombing or something? I said, no, we didn't talk them out. We listened them out. And they made then, because you give them a choice to do the right thing. It still means you acknowledge that they feel unfairly treated. So I think that you acknowledge that and it's okay. I don't judge. But I can give them to think about an option that they can achieve that differently. And they did a study on police interviews and they created an environment like light coming through the window and you would have like a cup of coffee, a meaningful conversation. And I think the statistics say 99% of people who committed a crime want to confess, want to do the right thing. And because of how police does interviews, which is all about attack, they shut up and they go back into drama triangle. But if you give them a choice to actually do the right thing, then you have both feel better.
This comes back to that binary hormone thing. If you create the conditions where they feel threatened, i.e. they perceive risk, any form of uncertainty, any form of vulnerability will lead to a perception of risk. All they have to do is perceive the risk. It doesn't have to be real. And in those moments, what people actually need is to be heard. You've just described a perfect, pain-free discovery process where every objection is an invitation to intimacy. That's beautiful. Now, if you're a salesperson, please go back over this and listen very carefully, because you have a blueprint to get out of the way of the customer and their decision to buy by eliminating 50% of the complexity just by taking yourself out of the equation. And Susanna's given you a framework. I teach an almost identical framework. I've been road testing it the last couple of weeks, and I've done 12 sales in a row, 100% close rate, and 9 role plays in a row, including with a 45-year veteran CFO, all of which ended up with not only a positive decision, but all the detail that I needed in order to be able to make a sensible, qualified decision as to whether we were right for each other and whether we could actually deliver the outcome that they needed, so that both sides would be happy and be able to willingly sign up to the same terms 100 times in a row, given identical conditions. No one would want to get out of that relationship. Now, compare that with having to go back and replace your people, replace your customers. It's expensive. It's time consuming. It's a massive preventable distraction. So talk to me. Clearly, I'm very good at the waffle as well. So talk to me about developing and practicing powerful deep listening and what the difference is between the weaponized active listening that so many salespeople employ and real listening.
Okay, so I give you, like, let's say a light version of it. As the FBI trains people, they just spend 2 weeks alone on one dimension of deep listening. So give you a shorter version. It starts with, and you can't do deep listening for a long time. So you need to give yourself, you listen for 2 minutes and then you go back to active and then you go back to deep. It starts with a real being super present. So you need to get yourself in the mindset of, I'm now at the service of this person. So it's like really a mind shift where you dedicate yourself and then you put yourself in a position. I think it has to do a lot also how you position yourself, that you can, that you're totally open to receive with all your senses. So if I'm just, the listeners will not see that we can see each other, but I can perceive you, Marcus. So I can see your facial language. I can see how what I say. And when you speak, I will take all of that in. I will go into myself and how does it make me feel what Marcus is saying? What words does he use? What values does he express? So I, in parallel, whilst I'm focusing on you, I'm taking that in because I will get a connection with you and I can feel what values you express through every word you say. I can see where your face changes when you say a certain word. So I can see this is an emotional word. So I take a note, a mental note or even a written note. And then I play it back to you. So I do this for 2 or 3 minutes at a time. Then I say, perhaps just the word, integrity, vulnerability. Those are the words you used about 20 to 30 times in our conversation today. So I get the sense this is really something important for you within the drama triangle, which you mentioned as well. So tell me more about. And then I give you the opportunity to continue what matters to you. I detach completely, and that is, I think, the most important lesson. I might ask you a question, but I, with questions comes great responsibility. In my trainings, I give my participants the permission to ask a question only if they at least demonstrated 3 or 4 paraphrasing or reflecting emotions, because if not, you don't deserve the right to ask a question. So it's easy to ask a question because you follow then your own agenda. If I listen to you and just say, for example, vulnerability, tell me more, but you don't want to talk about vulnerability, you tell me something else, it means I detach from my curiosity to know more about what you mean, because it's you who talks, not me. So I'm constantly giving myself the order or the permission to detach. I throw something out and at the same moment, I let go of what I said because it's you who will speak. And doing that, that is, I think you get, when you start training that, you, your brain really aches. And you also sometimes get overwhelmed with emotions because if someone in a conflict, for example, I heard lots of tough stuff in my mediation career, you need to protect yourself as well. I don't let the emotion in, but I'm able to feel them and I can reflect them back. I can see this is feels like a soul-destroying event in your life. And I pause. Silence is very important. A person might want to say something about it or not. That's the free will. That's the contract. I give always the choice that you want to talk about it or not. And then you have to set a time frame, because after a certain time you say, okay, can I please summarize what I've just heard? And let's see where you are and if you continue. And the summary is so crucial. And I wish in modern meetings could become actually more meaningful if you would apply all these skills and do proper summaries as well. And then the person then might say, yes, that's exactly what I meant. And then you deserve the right to say, okay, I think I might have understood. Never say, I understand. That's one of the sentences, until you deserve it.
That's very, very good advice. Okay, one of the challenges that a lot of people throw back is, well, this feels like it's going to take a long time. Now, my response to that is, well, you know, making hundreds and thousands of dials and wasting time on creating admin cost and loss seems equally unproductive, but we have to be kind about it. So we can't be quite that direct. So how do you respond when someone says, well, this is all well and good, Susanna, but you know, we need results fast?
I say, okay, you need to go slow to go fast. And I get the sense you're very anxious about results. So tell me more about your anxiety getting results. And we're immediately in a conversation. And the deep listening can be 2 minutes. I can listen 2 minutes to someone and get an essence of the value. I can play this back immediately. So it doesn't have to be very long. However, it means you need to take time to do it, because if not, you go directly from, which we call from an opening to a problem solving, without actually exploring what the real issue is. And I show empathy that someone says, I want to get results. Say, yeah, I get it.
And for those of you listening, Susanna has just given you a masterclass in how to welcome an objection and use that as an opportunity to create intimacy, which is the most important operator in the trust equation. So we spend so much of our time having been taught and acculturated to sell using pain. Pain, pain, pain equals dollar, dollar, dollar. That's what I was taught. That's what I taught. But when we do that, we trigger in the buyer's brain an association with threat. Then we're also taught through the dogma of the playbook that our job is to handle objections, power through them. Well, as a human being, as a buyer, and all sellers are buyers. So let me ask you this question, if you're listening. Would you want to buy from you? Because if the answer is even remotely no, then maybe take a look in the mirror, because you actually have choice. You can choose to behave differently. So we've established that you listen your way into sales, and you talk your way out of them. We've established that your job is to be fully present and create the space for the other person to tell their story and be the hero in their story. Because if you make the space for them to be the hero, then you can actually be their ally. And they will want you by their side as they go through their journey, trying to reach a decision. And the decision they want to make is the right one, not the wrong one, not a bad one, not one that will backfire on them. And your job as a seller, as a manager, as a leader, is to facilitate other people making good decisions well. If you do that, then you can trust delegating to other people. But you can't abdicate. So let's talk about abdication in communication. Let's look at some of those blind spots that we see in leadership.
So blind spots. I think leadership is one of those myths like collaboration. You put someone in a position and you think automatically, you have now a title, of course you can lead. I think that is I think, one of those false assumptions. Leadership, again, comes with, okay, humility, authenticity. I know that's all out there, tons of books, authentic leadership, etc. But it actually is true if you have not the humility to also ask for feedback and get an idea. How do I communicate? How do I come across? Do I actually understand what's going on around me? Have I a connection with my team members and my colleagues and with the business? If I'm shying away from that, also learning about where I might need to develop or be more consistent or make promises, I will never become a leader. And I might become a micromanager or a factory supervisor, but I not become a leader. And not everyone is a leader, but everyone is a leader. So self-leadership or leading myself, I think that is what we discussed, is getting out of the drama triangle, making choices, lifelong learning, putting myself out there, out of the comfort zone, find people who challenge me, having thought partners. I think that is all about leadership. You can do that without actually having the position of a leader. But let's say you have a position where you have to make decisions. You need to be on the top of your game, meaning being constantly aware and in connection and being an excellent listener to be able to do the job well. If not, you will be damned to mediocrity if that is what you want.
My belief is that leadership is a choice. It's not about title or status. It's a choice to make a decision in a moment where you believe something needs to be done differently and you choose to lead. One of my favorite ways of doing this is in meetings. Can we stop for a moment and just make sure that we're actually achieving what we intended to? How are you finding this meeting? So Susanna, Fred, Tom, Ginger, okay. And the objective is to get to the truth. I've worked out that there are six guide rails that I'm finding exceptionally useful.